Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Hey, we got the whole the bands back together for a reunion tour. Of course, we've got Jason Isengrind back from his whirlwind summer travel across the globe or halfway across the globe and driving his big red bus around the country. Back in action, Jason, for those of you that have not participated and watched one of our podcasts before, Jason is a retired special agent in charge from the OIG and the retired UPIC West director, and now our special director in charge, working on special projects here at Advise. And of course, I've got Matt Kachansky, also retired special agent in charge from HHS OIG, and the retired Northeast UPIC director and our payment integrity director here for our SIU team. And of course, Wade McFall, assistant special agent in charge from the LA office. Everybody has such very important titles except for me. And a manager on our SIU team. And of course, I am Eric Rubenstein. I am just a plain old retired agent from the OIG, and I am the senior director of litigation, fraud, waste, and abuse here. So we want to talk about a topic that is, it's not really SIU directed. It's just kind of one of these fraud, waste, abuse discussions where malpractice and fraud have kind of come together. And that is the recent charges involving the five people that were indicted and three having pled guilty relative to actor Matthew Perry's death from the ketamine overdose. And, you know, what we're learning is that three people have pleaded guilty. Those are lower level people. They're probably not just pleading guilty, but have probably signed cooperation agreements to cooperate against the two that are remaining, including the doctor that was the last known prescriber of the drugs. We'll talk a little bit about him. But, you know, the things that have come out regarding text messages and some of the things relative to the way that the medication was being dispensed to Matt Perry and just sort of the overall thing, and the fact that there's a potential malpractice issue. You know, the most amazing thing I think people are freaking out about today is that it was put out in the press that he's the doc that was giving him most of that medication, or at least recently giving him, is back at work, or is at least going back to work this week at the urgent care where he works. One of the odd things is that any patient that's going to see this doctor has to sign a waiver, which I thought was unique, but the medical board is doing its own investigation, and they are requiring that any patient that sees this doctor at an urgent care has to sign a waiver to see him, acknowledging that they're aware that he's an indicted co-conspirator in the death of Matthew Perry from these charges. So that is a unique thing. But Wade, I want to start with you because, you know, for a short period of time after you retired, you were over at on a CMS contract with the Medic, and then you were on one of our Medicaid contracts. And I want to talk about what's known as the PDMP or the PMP, Prescription Drug Monitoring Program or Prescription Drug Program. Every state has one. And many states have information sharing agreements among the states. Typically, like, for example, in New Jersey, I believe, like, you know, Pennsylvania, New York, Connecticut, it's sort of those surrounding states where they amalgamate the data. And what the PDMPs are state-run databases where when an individual goes to the pharmacy to get a prescription filled, that information is entered into the PDMP database. Prescribers of opioids, schedules 2 through 5, are supposed to input that information. They're supposed to be checking that information. And it's really to ensure that patients aren't drug-seeking beneficiaries. And there is some value in that data. But Wade, as you know from having used that data and looked at it, it is not a perfect data. And also, it is oftentimes difficult to use that data in certain ways because it is sometimes segmented and it's not amalgamated and things. So let's talk a little bit about that data. And this is really not necessarily relative to Matthew Perry's situation, because we talk a little bit about that. But this is for those who get an actual prescription and go to their pharmacy and get the drug filled, and, you know, things of that sort. And so let's talk a little bit about what the PDMP is, how it works, and, you know, where you would use it as an investigator.
Yeah, it basically, it's a mechanism to not only track the prescription itself, so the prescribing doctor, but also the dispensing end of it. So it kind of cross-references the prescription written by the doctor with the, whether it was dispensed at CVS or whatever the so the dispensary might may be. So in theory, it's kind of a good system to track drug-seeking beneficiaries, as we would call them. Those that are trying to get more, whatever it be, oxy or whatever, than they can really get from one physician. But the problem, as we discussed earlier, is when the prescribing doctors are involved with it, or the patient is getting it from sources that are not inputting this into the drug monitoring program. So it kind of takes, like, in theory, it's a good system for tracking drug seeking beneficiaries, but it kind of all goes out the window when you have that doctor who has, you know, decided that they're basically going to just do this for money, and they're not doing the typical, you know, Hippocratic oath type things that a doctor does. When it gets to this point, it's strictly a money situation, without getting, you know, too far off base, when medical decisions are being made based on a kickback or payment. You know, these systems in place to track the typical types of fraud, they kind of go out the window, because once the doctor is making these decisions strictly based on getting paid, it's just these systems really don't track that as well.
Right. And in this case, what we've come to learn is that Matthew Perry was paying this particular doctor in cash for these vials of ketamine. And what we've learned is that the doctor was buying these vials at $12 a piece and charging $6,000 or $10,000, whatever that number, some obscene amount of money for that. And that, you know, falls into that category of kind of this doctor administrated. And I think people become a little amazed when they find out that doctors can get medication and dispense it. But, you know, under the Medicare Part B as in boy benefit, physicians oftentimes are administering medication to patients and then billing for that under different codes. For example, the J codes are common codes that are used for the administration of medication. And you often see physician-infused medications, chemotherapy, for example, drugs for Crohn's disease, some drugs for rheumatoid arthritis that are out there that are physician-administered drugs, can result in very large profits, because the pharmaceutical industry will do something called marketing the spread, which is to tell a doctor, hey, this is how much it's costing you, and this is how much you can bill for it, and you can, you know, kind of work, you know, work from there. But Jason, I want to go to you now, because there's a piece of this that is an important piece, which is the fact that there's this prospect of licensure revocation and this whole thing. And, you know, oftentimes, I know when we were working cases at the OIG, we would oftentimes have these conversations where people would say, well, is the doctor going to lose his license or her license, or what's going to happen to them? And, you know, the big issue is that that's a state issue. It has nothing to do with the prosecution of an individual, but more importantly, that they're really, this is where that conversation of coordination of effort comes into play. Because while the medical boards are making independent assessments of things, it doesn't mean that there shouldn't be a dialogue between the law enforcement community and the licensing community, and being on the same page for things like that.
Absolutely. Dovetailing to Wade's excellent points, though, is that there are some pretty decent resources for the mitigation of abuse and fraud for Medicare and Medicaid-related patients. It kind of stops and hits maybe not a brick wall, maybe just a fence that you have to leap over, because most of the states, as you point out, Eric, the administrative component of looking at providers that are over prescribing, you know, or poor record keeping or whatever else, are done by state entities. And the reality is that those resources vary greatly between states. And I'll just say that in some of the smaller states, smaller in program size, there there might be two, you know, investigators for the whole state. It's just ridiculously small where, you know, so as far as the federal component, UPICs are looking at the pharmaceuticals and the dispensing of them through the UPICs, right? They have the Medicaid component of it. And then on the Medicare side is the Medic, as you mentioned. And, you know, when you add up all those resources, there's probably, you know, close to 500 investigators and nurse auditors and nurse reviewers and data analysts across those components, probably even more than that. So that's pretty decent, as I said. But again, when it comes down to a small state, and I won't name any, but it's pathetically small. The other thing I want to say, though, is that, as you know, to your intro, Eric, even though the bottom line is that the dispensing of these drugs, there's a collateral damage as a result of it. And it, so even if it's not being paid for by a program, so whether it's an SIU problem or not, is my point, is that the reality is that it obviously causes health issues that then the plans are paying for because of that overprescribing or misprescribing. So, you know, it's a root cause issue. And I'll just say that the last thing I'll say about it is that the collection of data is important. And so there are some pretty good data collection efforts going on, but then it kind of wanes greatly in terms of what are you going to do with that data? And the reality is that one of the most effective tools I've seen in the mitigation of drug diversion are inventory audits in pharmacies. And I've always thought that an inventory, with air quotes, audit on the manufacturing end would be very interesting, you know, where there are 10 million of these pills manufactured and there's records for 500,000 of them. Well, there's a problem. And following where those went would lead to some very interesting situations.
You know, so the interesting thing that you talk about, which is inventory reconciliation, one of the biggest challenges that the PBM industry has, I encountered this as an OIG agent, we've encountered it on projects we've worked here, is that because there isn't a sharing of data, PBMs can only have purview into their own things. And so the example I always like to give is PBM one goes and does an inventory reconciliation and says to the pharmacy, hey, you billed us for 100 aspirin. Show us the invoices for 100 aspirin for this 30-day time period. And the pharmacy goes, okay, we'll go to the wholesaler. We'll get those inventory records and we'll have the wholesaler send them to you. Because remember, PBMs do not have relationships with the wholesalers. They have relationships with the pharmacies. That's the contractual agreement. And so the pharmacy says to the wholesaler, get me those inventory records. By the way, send them to me first. I'll look at them and then we'll say, okay, and then send them. So at the end of the day, what the wholesaler does, the wholesaler sends invoices that show 100 aspirin for the 30-day time period was purchased. PBM one says, okay, inventory good, you're good to go. Let's say a month later, PBM two comes in and PBM two says to the same pharmacy, hey, you billed us for 100 aspirin. Get us the wholesaler records for this for that 30-day period, and it's the same 30-day period from pharmacy PBM one. Well, you've got the same wholesaler records going for the same drug to a different PBM. Well, the second PBM is going to say, "Hey, you're good. You billed us for 100 aspirin. We've got wholesaler records for 100 aspirin. We're good." The problem is, we know it's not good. And when I was at the OIG, we would do these and you would see these differences because you were seeing amalgamated, right, or aggregated data that the PBMs don't get to see. And that's part of the problem in the pharmacy industry when you're trying to do these shortages or these inventory reconciliations. To your point, Jason, where that would kind of be circumvented was if there was the ability to get aggregated information to show, hey, you know, wholesaler one or manufacturer one, how many pills did you give to that pharmacy in the aggregate? And then each PBM gets to see that and say, well, wait a minute, these numbers don't seem to match. But part of that problem is PBM one and PBM two, they're not sharing their information, right? It's no different than if we're looking at an impossible day where a provider may have rendered 8 hours of services and billed it to Medicare. And then they've gone and they've billed 8 hours of services to Blue Cross Blue Shield of whomever, or the book is of whomever. Before you know it, it's 150 hours worth of work, but nobody really gets to see that unless you're on the law enforcement side and you're kind of getting that, you know, getting that purview of it. But it is an interesting piece of the puzzle. And obviously with this case, there was nothing that was coming out of a PBM. It was cash. There was nothing that was being reported on the PDMP. It was cash. So that exacerbates the ability to actually do this investigation in a timely manner, because now you're having to track a vial of a drug that was being provided in an off-label manner. And, you know, ketamine is a Schedule III. Oddly enough, cannabis, marijuana, Schedule I, although it may be moved to a Schedule III. But, you know, the fact that marijuana is considered to be a Schedule I drug and there are 20-plus states that have recreational use of it, ketamine is considered a three. It's a horse tranquilizer, animal tranquilizer. It's a club drug known as Special K, but a huge amount of diversion. And from an off-label perspective, when used in proper clinical settings, it is used to treat severe depression, PTSD, and the like. And so it's really a little bit less about whether or not Matt Perry should have been prescribed this drug or not. The odd thing is that in his autopsy report, they did find that one of the other drugs that he had in his system was buprenorphine, which is a drug that is used to combat opioid addiction and negate opioid addiction. Drugs like Supsis, which is the spray, the sublingual spray, is oftentimes used for some of that. But it is interesting that, you know, there was this whole premise of that the guy is back at work, the doctor is back at work. So Matt, I want to kind of take it to that next level, because this, you know, this is, you've got a potential healthcare fraud, but not really, because it's, you know, there's no claims being submitted or anything like that. But you've got this issue of potentially drug diversion, which I guess could fall into a healthcare fraud discussion, but then also the premise of the medical malpractice going on and the fact that this person is still out there, and that, you know, as investigators, we need to be able to stay in that lane and not move out of that lane into discussions of licensure and things of that sort. It's a very slippery slope.
Right. And it's, there should be parallel tracks, but there should be some dialogue between them. Like if we ever have a case of, you know, malpractice or abuse of a patient, we obviously then refer those matters to the state licensing boards, and they have their own track for investigating and resolving those things. And they have their own, you know, administrative elements that they have to meet and things like that. You know, and they can take emergency actions if needed, or go through the whole process of through the board hearings and then come up with a decision at the end to suspend the license, terminate the license, put someone on probation, that sort of thing. And that's done at the state level by the medical boards. As an investigator on an SIU, sometimes it's good to have a dialogue with the people involved in that, because they can provide some information to you, not much, some information as to what they're doing and what information they're finding that may help your fraud and abuse case, and vice versa. If you come across other instances of abuse by the, you know, or malpractice by the physician, you should be getting that information to the board as soon as you can. But what you'll see is, frankly, from an investigator's point of view, it's a lot of, there's a lot of walls up between the two. You're not going to get a lot of information. It's going to take longer than you think it should. You're going to have physicians like this guy who's been indicted, where a grand jury has said there's, you know, reasonable, you know, there's evidence to show that he has committed a crime, but yet he's still allowed to practice. And that's just frustrating, but it is a different track that they follow. For Medicare, we can't suspend or revoke a provider based on an indictment. It's got to be a conviction, whether that's a plea or a conviction in trial, before we can take action. Even though in our heart of hearts, we think that that person's a danger to the program and perhaps to its patients, Medicare will not take action until there is a legal action that allows for it. And it's frustrating.
Right. Well, let's just clarify that, because in some instances, CMS can seek to take action and suspend a provider when there's, as they call it, the credible allegation of fraud. And so, you know, part of that is that you've got to be able to demonstrate through a complaint, indictment, something like that, a credible allegation of fraud. The problem is, in this case, the charges are relative to death by overdose or whatever they're charging ultimately with the DEA charges were, or what have you. And so while we all look at this and in our minds, we're like, there's got to be fraud here. At the end of the day, the argument is there is no credible allegation of fraud. And so a suspension is not going to take place. The other piece of this puzzle, too, is that, you know, I don't even know if this guy that's been indicted, is he a Medicare, Medicaid participating provider? I would think that he's working at an urgent care center. I would think that he is. You know, you get very rarely do you see people that are not Medicare, Medicaid, you know, unless there's certain types of specialties or whatever. But, you know, that becomes a piece of that puzzle. While you have to allow those parallel processes to take place, you know, when you've got something like this, where there is no credible allegation of fraud, it sometimes can create an additional barrier to being able to take action. And by the way, suspending the provider from the Medicare Medicaid program doesn't stop them from anything involving the practice of the medicine or anything along those lines. Just
suspends the payments. Right. And looking at this case and looking at a lot of similar cases, very difficult to investigate and prove. Here you've got a victim who drowned, you know, with a ancillary cause of a ketamine overdose, knocking him out, and he goes under the water and drowns. What killed him, the water or the ketamine? And who gave him the ketamine? You've got a doctor that didn't prescribe him anything, was selling him stuff at a time period where he was using it. And then there's another person indicted as well that was also selling him, not even a healthcare provider. You know, who gave him the dose that, you know, the big one at the end?
Right.
It's going to be very difficult to prove that. Similarly, on the, you know, for an SIU, the same things come up. You know, did they use the drugs that were prescribed by the person, or did they get them somewhere else? You don't know that. The PDMP is not going to show that. So it's very difficult to prove those cases.
Right. Well, and the other challenge is going to be that, you know, when doctors have what are typically known as plenary licenses, that means that they can basically prescribe anything that they want for anything. Yeah. I mean, you can go to a doctor and the doctor could say to you, hey, I think that you should do X, Y, Z for this condition, and I'm going to write you a prescription for it. And it could be a prescription for something that is totally unrelated to what they want you to use it for. And so that becomes an absolute factor. The thing here that I think is going to be one of the challenges is going to be forgetting the fact that the doctor was getting this drug for $12 and charging $6,000, right? That's clearly some drug-seeking behavior, right? I'm willing to pay whatever I can pay. But at the end, if the doctor says, and forgetting the text, like how much is this moron willing to pay? That's a separate issue, right? From what if at the end, the doc says, hey, I gave him this ketamine and I told him never take more than 1 cc 3 times a day. You know, the fact that it's no different than someone who gets a script for OxyContin or fentanyl and they, you know, take a big hit. And, you know, the example I like to give and where I think, you know, you get these differences is when you've got somebody getting a prescription that they are filling at a pharmacy where the provider is not only writing a prescription, but also billing for an office visit where there's an interaction of those things. And the example I like to give is right before I retired, I worked on a case involving, it was a really sad case. It was a girl who was in her early 20s from a fairly well-off family. They owned horses and stables. And in a horse riding accident, she injured her back and it resulted her in being addicted to oxy and fentanyl. Phone call was made. She was found dead in her basement. The bottle of oxy that had been refilled a day or two before was found by her body empty. And she had a fentanyl patch on her back. And the issue was that, you know, she took a big hit and overdosed. The crazy part, it was, you know, she was going to the doctor. He was an internal medicine doctor, not a pain management doctor. He was not even board certified in internal medicine. He had just renewed his New Jersey CDS controlled license. He had lied on the application for the renewal and said that he regularly checked the PDMP, the prescription drug monitoring program. When he was interviewed, he did two things. He acknowledged that 94% approximately of his patients were on an opioid, and he indicated that he wrote those prescriptions because his patients intimidated him. So he gave in and wrote the prescriptions. The other thing was when he was interviewed, it came to light that he didn't even know what the PDMP was, but he checked the box. He had never logged into the PDMP system, had no idea what it was. And when this lady was going to the pharmacy to get her prescriptions filled, she would flip-flop each month. One month she would pay cash for one drug, use her insurance for the other, and then vice versa. So the PDMP has its limitations. And unless you're actually looking at this provider and doing these analytics, the PBM is not going to see this. The payer's not going to see it. She was actually on Medicare, which is why we got involved on the OIG perspective, because she was getting Social Security disability and was getting. And so the doctor was billing every month for an office visit to rewrite the prescriptions for her. But, you know, these kind of things, they fall through the cracks. But, in this particular instance, the challenges are there's going to be no claims going to an insurance company. There's going to be no payment made by a PBM or an insurance company. These are cash deals. It's really a drug diversion. We're going to have to see where it plays out. But, you know, Matt, to kind of give you that closeout is exactly what the point you're making is he drowned. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? Did the ketamine kill him, or did the ketamine put him into such a state, right, a mental state where he drowned as a result of, you know, kind of sinking into his hot tub, as a result? And that's going to present a challenge of how do you charge? And if there is, in fact, documentation that, you know, this doctor specifically instructed him not to take more than X cc's a day, more than, you know, that's going to be a challenge that I think will be hard. You know, and this is part of why we don't see a lot of these kinds of cases prosecuted in the world. It's sad to say, but, you know, these become battles of the experts. And so, Matt, you know, as kind of Jason, he comes in as a guest, but he's got something.
I just want to add one thing to that. So, you know, you brought up earlier about like, well, how is this person still employed and they're involved in this? Well, the employers, so whether it's a health plan, health system, what individual hospital, whatever, they're concerned about being sued, and they're also concerned about losing a provider that maybe providing then cause an access to care issue that they're limited. But in a couple of consultations I've had with health plans and providers is that they should think about like their agreement with the provider. What, much like you brought up about the, CMS has a credible allegation and a payment suspension, they should maybe put something more robust in their provider agreement that allows them to take some sort of administrative action in the meantime until the investigation is complete. And it would at least put a framework in place for them to maybe take some sort of interim action.
Yeah, and that's the big challenge. And then for this provider, because this was a DEA drug diversion case, he did get his DEA license suspended. So he cannot write prescriptions for any scheduled 2 through 5 drugs. And I'm going to guess collaterally, he's not going to be able to order ketamine because you need a CDS to do that. So there are going to be some collateral consequences. So, okay, he's not going to be able to write a prescription for ketamine, but, you know, as an, at an urgent care center, he's probably not writing a lot of prescriptions for narcotics and opioids or anything like that. So, but Matt, I want to go to you for kind of this final thought, because from an investigative perspective, right, and as a as someone who was in management and leadership and even now on our SIU team, we have to be super careful about where we potentially draw our line on our investigations. Where is this a healthcare fraud case, or is this something that should be referred? Because even at an SIU, we talk about this all the time, internal and external stakeholders. You've got to make some of these determinations pretty quickly from at least, you know, we'll loop this into an ROI conversation.
Right. Yeah, there's got to be program damage, whether it's through the E&M visits that they're charging or the prescriptions that they're writing. They're not being, you know, the provider's not getting paid for the prescriptions, but the plan is probably being charged for them through the pharmacy. So you've got to put your resources where the money is. And what you really have to look at is the practice of medicine. You know, is this just a practice of medicine question that's going to bring in the battle of the experts, where I'm a pain doctor, I've got these people with intractable chronic pain, this is how we're treating them, and we're giving them the right instructions. We can't help it sometimes if they go beyond that, go to other places to get other drugs or whatever it may be, and OD because of it. That's not on us, because we're testing them and doing all the proper things, but they're doing it anyway. We have the guardrails up, but they're getting around them. So as an SIU, you've got to look for those cases that are more, you know, point blank. You know, is there a doctor out there that's a huge outlier in bad outcomes to their, you know, their ODs and deaths based on this prescriber's pattern? And look for those top of the line ones and go after those, because other than that, you're going to be getting into the battle of experts and getting into the practice of medicine. And it's very, very difficult.
Right. And look, we're not making this a conversation about prescribing and, you know, providers that get charged under Title 21 and healthcare fraud and whether they overprescribed or like that. It's really just more an empirical thing. And by the way, I misspoke before. I talked about Subsys and buprenorphine. They're not the same. Subsys is the sublingual spray version of fentanyl for breakthrough cancer pain that is oftentimes off-labelly prescribed for people with other types of intractable pain, not necessarily breakthrough. Mm-hmm. And buprenorphine is the drug that is given to patients to wean them off of opioids, similar to like methadone or something like that. So I misspoke when I said that. So yeah, this is interesting to see what happens. Why we've got 3 plea of guilty, we've got 2 that are outstanding. It's going to be interesting to see what happens now that these charges have been filed. There has been a ton of stuff out there in the press about it, and discussions, a lot of legal scholars talking about the fact that this rose to a U.S. Attorney's Office level case when cases like this are typically done at the local or the state level. So it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out over the next little bit. Once discovery, according to the doc's lawyer, a discovery has not been turned over. So the doctor doesn't know if there's going to be a trial or a plea, but it'll be interesting to see how that all gels out over the next few months. At the end of the day, it's a terrible story of someone. And it's even, I think, exacerbated more by the fact that it's someone who had a lot of money and could actually afford to spend this money to feed what ultimately became a drug habit that started off with good intention, right? The story is that the addiction to the ketamine was the result of him being in in-house treatment for a variety of things, including maybe some severe depression and things of that sort. So, you know, these things all happen. I mean, I think that's why you're seeing now this inordinate reluctance of healthcare providers to prescribe opioids. And when you do see instances of people getting opioid prescriptions, it's 3 days or 4 days, no refills or none of that, because there is this fear of abuse and overuse. You know, I think the holy grail is the day when an opioid-like medication becomes invented that has no addictive properties to it. And I think that, you know, when a drug like that comes out on the market, a lot of these conversations will be moot points because a lot of these scheduled drugs just won't be a factor when they come out with something like that. And I think in our lifetime, we may see it, certainly in mine, because I'm the youngest of the four of us. Maybe not for you old guys, but we'll have to see.
They are coming out with a ketamine spray.
So, yeah. So there you go. An alternative delivery method, because right now the primary delivery method of ketamine is injection, either IV or direct. So, yeah, you know, I do think with some of the trials going on right now with ketamine, that there's going to be a change in its on-label use. If I recall correctly, ketamine was invented back in the 50s or 60s, and it was used as a counter to things like, you know, in lieu of things like LSD, which were tested, you know, post-war and things of that sort. So I think there's probably some efficacy that we're starting to see from some of these clinical trials on how ketamine works and how it can be effective for example, the people that have severe PTSD and depression and stuff. So we'll see. We'll monitor this and we'll see where this all goes. It's going to be interesting to see how this all turns out, particularly with the two people that haven't pled guilty. But then also, if this does go to trial, the three people that are cooperating, what are they going to say? That's always going to be the thing that's always interesting is what are the people that are cooperating have to say? What documents do they have? It is very possible that the three people cooperating were the impetus for some of those text messages or maybe some other documents that are out there. So we'll monitor it. We'll see what happens. But as always, great conversation. I think we went a little bit longer than normal, but this is a pretty big case. It's a lot of interesting twists. As always, good to have you, Jason. Welcome back. Good to see you back here wearing your official OIG Roundtable shirt. Appreciate that. As always, thanks to everybody who participates by email, joining up. We really appreciate it. Again, you can get our weekly newsletter delivered to your inbox on Fridays. Just go to our website, advizehealth.com. You can get it right into your Friday email, OIG Roundtable every week. You can get our monthly LinkedIn Live, register for those. We've got a whole bunch coming up. We've got one next week that's going to be a great one. We're going to talk about auditors, coders, and clinical documentation people. I'm going to be speaking with one of the nurses on one of our UPIC contracts who is an RNCPC. We're going to talk all about the importance of that role in the fraud, waste, abuse continuum. We've got a whole bunch of other LinkedIn Live scheduled through the rest of the year. Look forward to that. And as always, we really do appreciate everyone's support. And until next time, we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable.